Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
The Andy J Podcast. The Andy J Podcast. The Andy J Podcast.
Hey, welcome to the very latest Andy J Podcast. Thanks for choosing us to be your audio companion for the next hour or so. Now, my guest this week is pretty special, a founding member of Boyzone. He was also went on to become a very big actor. He was in Coronation Street twice, and he's a massive campaigner for children with learning difficulties, and he's just a very insightful and fascinating man. I am, of course, talking about Keith Duffy. Now, this is fun because I have spoken to a couple of Keith's bandmates previously. I've had Roland Keith on this show, as hopefully you've heard. I've also had his Westlife buddy, who he is in a band with called Boys Life, Brian McFadden, on the show. And I've had Shane Lynch on the show, also from Boyzone. So it's nice to be able to put some more of the jigsaw puzzle pieces together, if you know what I mean. So I kind of came into this knowing a little bit about Keith, and obviously ahead of every interview I always do a fair chunk of research. So I was really, really looking forward to chatting to Keith, and I thought he'd be quite a ball of energy and fascinating. I didn't realise he would be on kind of guru level thinking with some of his thoughts and experiences on the world. He is a terrific, terrific guy, really good company, really, really enjoyed this chat. So I hope you enjoy listening to it as much as I enjoyed having it. Thank you for choosing us. Tell your friends, share, follow, subscribe, whatever the words are these days. Please spread the word and enjoy Keith Duffy.
The Andy J Podcast.
A man who's entertained us for over 25 years. First, in one of the most successful boy bands of all time, Boyzone. And then, as an actor and an advocate, you'll remember him from two stints on Coronation Street, for example. I'm very pleased to welcome Mr. Keith Duffy. How are you doing, Keith?
Well, you know what, Andy? I'm just delighted. I'm delighted that you could read my writing from my intro. That was great. Well done. Well written.
Do you know what, Keith? I never rehearse these intros, right? I just kind of busk them. And I kind of thought to myself, well, how do I do you justice? I can't, because of the amount of things you've done. You know, if I could basically spend an hour talking about how many people you've performed to and the new band and all sorts of other things, but then we wouldn't have any time to chat.
Well, maybe you don't need to speak to me at all. Maybe you know it all already.
That would be, I mean, I'm not sure many people would tune in for that, to be honest, Keith. I do these long intros, as you've heard, and hope people will stay with us. They're here for you, my friend. That's what it's all about.
Well, the intro was fantastic, Andy. Like I said, it was like as if I wrote it myself.
Well, I'll save it for you and send it to you as a ringtone, if you like, if you're ever having one of those low days. I mean, Keith, let's... Your achievements are ridiculous. You know, it's when we look at the statistics around, I mean, Boyzone on its own, if that's all you've done in your career, you've done an awful lot. But you've done so much more since, and you've also used your fame for incredible good things. So, Keith, if we can have a sort of walk through your life, not necessarily in chronological order, just kind of what's important to you and so on. But let's just start very quickly, because, you know, it sounds like that little intro has given you a lift. Just to kind of put this out there front and centre, being in the public eye, living the life you live and so on, it sounds amazing, it sounds fantastic, but it's not always just happy, 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 is it?
Well, no, of course not. Nothing in life ever is. I mean, we've all got our ups and downs in life. I mean, I have a very, very private family life away from all the glitz and the glamour, that has got, you know, real content, real problems, real situations that has to be dealt with. I mean, I suppose some people sometimes look at people in my business and kind of think that we were born into the business and we were born to do what we do. But the truth is we're not. I mean, I had a very, very real, hard kind of working class upbringing before Boyzone was ever even an idea, you know. I mean, I was out working the age of 13, 14 years of age, trying to bring in extra cash at home to help my parents. You know, I mean, they worked very, very hard. But, you know, where we grew up and, you know, and life in Dublin back in the 80s, it was tough, you know. So you know, we were very grounded lads in Boyzone for that reason, that we weren't born into it. But yes, I mean, to answer your question, there's a lot of other things. There's a lot of moving parts in everybody's life, and especially people that are in the that are in the public eye. People kind of assume that that's the only part of your life, but nobody knows what goes on behind closed doors. Nobody knows that, you know, when I go home, you know, I've got all sorts of upset to deal with. Or maybe I don't. Maybe I go home and life is absolutely brilliant and dreamful, you know, but it's never either or the other all of the time. You know, I suppose it's like Forrest Gump said, life is like a box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get.
Hey, listen, any interview that quotes Forrest Gump is going straight to the top of my favourite chats, because that's a seminal movie if ever there was one, Keith. I mean, no, it's like, who was it that said it? Is it Michael Stipe that wrote that lyric, "It's been a bad day, please don't take my picture"?
Yeah, that's the truth behind it, really. I mean, look, I was listening to the radio driving the other day, and they had people on the ground from the radio station stopping people randomly and asking them, is it okay for celebrities or people with familiar faces to get annoyed when somebody stops them outside of their work and asks them outside of their work hours? So in their own personal life,
yeah,
you know, whether it be walking the street or in a restaurant or at the cinema or whatever, is it okay for a celebrity to get annoyed, to get upset with them for looking for, excuse me, an autograph or a photograph? You know, and it was bizarre to hear the reaction. I was pleasantly surprised, actually. Most people's reaction was, you know, everybody is entitled to a private life. You know, when you're working, when you're kind of, you know, out there doing the thing that you do that makes you, you know, famous or a celebrity, you know, by all means, you know, you should be able to be approached by people and people that have put you where you are, and people that have helped your career along the way. You should absolutely have time for those people in that environment. But when you're in an environment of family and private life, you know, what is the right and wrong way to go forward? Should you be available to people all the time? Should you be able to walk away from the dinner table in a restaurant where you're dining with your wife and your children to get a photograph taken? Or should you be allowed to say, excuse me, sorry, I'm with my family, I'm having my dinner, if you don't mind, when I'm finished eating, I possibly might be able to take a photograph, but for now, I'm a bit tied up. Nobody can give you the kind of the right or wrong answer. Yeah. It's all down to the individual, really, you know?
Yes, and I mean, I'm assuming you get scores of these issues, Keith. I can imagine actually having to say that, can I just finish my food first, sort of thing, must be really difficult, actually, because then people kind of shuffle back to their table and they probably say under their breath, oh, God, can't believe you didn't have time for us and all this kind of thing. Even though you've kind of said, just give me a beat, let me have some family time, and then you get your picture. You can't win, yeah, really, can you?
Again, you can't generalise, because some people will completely understand your predicament, will respect your request, And they'll be happy to sit and wait. Whereas then you've got the other people, like the people you just mentioned, that will speak under their breath and possibly get on social media and call you all sorts of names. And then without your permission, and people think they're being very clever, but honest to God, I've seen it all before. You know, they pretend to be on their phone, but they're videoing you or they're taking photographs of you. And that can be very upsetting. Look, you know, when they do that, when I'm sat on my own in an airport or a train station, it's funny, okay, because I'll pick up my phone. And I learned this from the late, great Stephen Gately. He was brilliant at this, you know. And back in those days, you know, phones were only starting to have cameras on them. They weren't smartphones. They're just phones and cameras. And if he ever caught people taking a photo of them or videoing them without asking him, he would just do the same back. He'd walk over to their face and he would take a picture of them. He'd go, now, I've got your photograph too. And he's so funny. Brilliant. He'd make the rest of us laugh, you know. Listen, I'll be very honest. And if any of you, I don't know whether you take callers or not, Andy, I'm sure anybody out there that's met me will tell you. I would be one of the most approachable people in the business. I've been in the business now since 92, 93, which is what, nearly 28 years. And I was very, very aware that, you know, you have to have time for the people that put you where you are. It's easy to say, no, I'm busy. It's easy to kind of keep walking and ignore the excuse me. But it's, you know, it takes somebody else with a bit of integrity to to kind of stop, acknowledge the people that are asking you for something, you know, listen to what they have to say, and then make a judgment on whether it's the right or wrong thing to do. But just to ignore it blankly is just rude, in my opinion. I do believe we all are entitled to a private life. So when I'm dining with my children, and I have a daughter with special needs, and I don't like people taking a photograph of me with my family, unless, of course, it's agreed by me previously. If I'm on my own, it's a different scenario altogether. But when with the family and with my kids, you know, I would be the first to say, and I'd be very polite, but I would say, listen, I appreciate your support, but please, can you just, you know, respect my privacy for half an hour while I have dinner with my family, and then I'll only be too happy to join you for a drink or to get a photograph taken or whatever it is you might be looking for. But just, you know, I chose to be in this business. I chose to throw myself into it, but my family didn't make that choice. Mm. So they're still entitled to have a private meal without being interrupted, you know?
Yes, I completely hear you, Keith. And you're absolutely right. When it comes to, you know, taking photographs of your family, your kids and so on, that's not cool. That's overstepping. I mean, Keith, I'm going to sort of, it's slightly playful really, but one of the challenges I'm guessing you have is you're quite a good looking fella. Do you know what I mean? You're a handsome man. So you're quite...
I would just stop. God, you know all the right things to say.
No, but you are, Keith. Come on. You're a good looking fella. And therefore, and man, you're 47 at the moment. You don't look it. You're going to have to give me some tips because I look about 100 at the moment, but you are quickly recognizable. You know, you were in kind of one of the biggest bands in the world for such a long time. You're still a huge, huge known person, massively in the public eye. So do you ever, I'm kind of getting a little bit Beatles about here, but do you ever do a disguise?
No.
Oh.
It's quite a bizarre one, to be honest, because, you know, when in Boyzone, I didn't do the lead vocals. I mean, that was predominantly Rona Keaton and Stephen Gately. And, you know, we were suppressed, the other three of us, because Louis Walsh had this kind of belief, you know, that the sound of Boyzone was Ronan and Stephen, and we had such success, you know, with them singing the lead vocals in the singles, that it was kind of like the situation was, if it's not broken, don't fix it. So as a result, we were pushed to the back quite a bit, and you know, with that, then you lose your confidence, your self-esteem, your belief in yourself, you know, and then when you do get an opportunity to stand up and sing, You know, you don't have the confidence that you would have had you been up the front all along.
Right.
So it's quite bizarre how often and regularly I am recognized, because, like I said at the start of the interview, I mean, I believe I'm a very grounded person. You know, it's the women in my life that keep me very grounded. You know, my mother, Irish mammies, you know, I mean, they don't allow for their sons to become famous and well known. You're still sent over to the supermarket to get the vegetables for the dinner, regardless of your status. You know what I mean? If dinner's being cooked and we're short a couple of red peppers, well, Keith, get over to those shops and get me sorted. You know, and, you know, my I've been with my wife since before Boyzone, so we've been together since we were kids. So, like, I mean, she's not going to make any allowances for the fact that I chose a job in the public eye and that I'm famous or I'm a celebrity or whatever word you want to use, you know. And then there's my daughter, Mia, who's the most amazing human being in the world. And, you know, Mia has autism and wouldn't even, you know, begin to kind of give me any kind of praise for the job that I do, because it's just your job, okay? So with that said, you know, I live a very grounded life. And it's bizarre, it's weird for me, the fact that I do get recognized as often as I do. And even through the pandemic, the COVID-19 thing, when we got the opportunity to wear masks everywhere, you would imagine that would give me, you know, a disguise and the ability to be able to go about my business, you know, without anybody interrupting me. And it's so funny. I mean, I'm walking into shops with a mask and a baseball cap on, and I can already see the girl behind the counter in the shop smiling at me like she knows me. And I'm going, have I not got my mask on to myself? And I have. And she goes, God, she says, I know those eyes anywhere. How's it going, Keith Duffy? You know, it's like, wow, even with my mask on, people recognize me. It's crazy, you know.
It must be like quite fun at times as well, though. I mean, I realize it's just happening all the time endlessly, but like, even with your mask on, that's quite an accolade, isn't it? You know, even when you're in
Look, I have to say to you, though, I don't see myself in those lights. I mean, the people, it's my heroes that I look up to. I mean, my heroes growing up were the likes of U2 and, and the guys out of U2, Bono and Larry Mullen, the drummer from U2. I mean, to me, they're superstars. They're celebrities. They're the rock stars, you know. You know, look, I don't know. I suppose A-list Hollywood actors. I mean, Michael Jackson. I mean, you know, Mariah Carey. I mean, I don't know. I've never really looked at myself on a level playing field with these superstars. So it's difficult for me. It's like, you know, I look at all these reality TV shows that we have now, you know, and whether it's Love Island or I don't know, my wife watches these Married at First Sight or Love is Blind, or there's all these reality shows where these people, you know, go on to become celebrities and have like, you know, 3 million followers on their Instagram page, and they go around the world getting paid to turn up at events and stuff. And I go to myself, well, you know, I don't really believe in that. I don't really respect that, because for me, I mean, the word celebrity I don't like anyway, but I mean, you have to do the graft to earn your time, to earn your 15 minutes, you know, whether it be going through acting school and being a jobbing actor, working in coffee shops and getting your first acting gig and working in the local fringe theater, and then maybe getting an audition and getting into the West End, and from the West End, maybe getting a part in Coronation Street or, you know, or a movie, you know, or whether you're in the music business and you start off busking at the side of the street and somebody notices you and gives you a break, and you manage to get a record deal for one song and the song goes to radio, and it's, you know, and you get a bit of popularity from the song, and then you record an album, and you know, or you know, whether you're a TV presenter and you start at the bottom and you're hosting the local panto and you're doing MC at a talent competition, and then somebody notices you and you get a gig on TV, and you know, you earn your craft and you work hard and you dedicate your life to your career, to your art, and you become famous because of your success of what you do. But to become famous for being famous, for me, it's terrible. I mean, why would you want to give away your anonymity for free? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You're giving it away for free.
No,
why do that?
You're preaching to the converted here, Keith. I've said this many times on the show. I don't understand the appeal of the reality. It's that kind of shortcut, no talent related, instant fame, which what? Buys you a bit of limelight, gets you a few newspaper headlines, might put a few quid in your pocket, but it also, what we've seen, gets taken away very, very quickly because it's not rooted in talent, because it's not rooted in a skill. It goes. You know, you might be known because you were the guy or the girl that had sex with that person in that space, or, you know, you'd done a few push-ups, so you looked good on telly a couple of times, and then what happens? You know, the next reality show comes in and you're gone.
There's no foundation of talent. There's no foundation of graft, of work, you know, of preparation. I mean, God knows, when Boyzone started back in 92, 93, we weren't great at all. There was a lot of better and more talented people in the world, but we grafted hard. We had to take the good with the bad. It didn't start off on the stage of Wembley Arena. You know, we used to play clubs and pubs around Ireland. We used to get ice cubes thrown at us, money, twopences and fivepences thrown at us on stage because the guys didn't like us, but the girls did. You know, we did clubs from Donegal at the very north of Ireland down to Cork and Cove, the very south of Ireland. And we were playing to like 50 people. We were playing to 200 people. You know, we were going into nightclubs where, you know, back in the 90s in a disco, you'd have your popular music, but then you'd have a slow set where the guy and the girl got to do a dance. And it's when the guy got to ask the girl he fancied that she'd like to dance, and they have a close kind of slow dance where they might have a little snog, and boys don't start getting booked to play in the slot where the slow set used to be. So the guys used to hate us because we were taking away their opportunity of snogging the local girl, you know?
Yeah, yeah, I could see them being beefed about that. And
so, no, I mean, there was a lot of graft. There was a lot of sacrifice. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm not complaining. I'm very, very grateful for the opportunities that I've been given in life. But the sacrifices you make with family, you don't get to sit and have breakfast with your kids every day. You don't get to tuck them into bed at night and give them a bedtime story because you're on the other side of the world working, providing. You know, yes, it's a great opportunity for a single man, but when you become in this business and you have a family, the sacrifices are huge, you know, and you have to earn it. You really have to earn it. And you're not allowed to complain because you've been given an opportunity to travel around the world and see places that you never get to see usually. So you keep your tongue, you say thank you, and you get on about your business. And then, like I say, you realize how important your anonymity is. And the fact that you have to give it away when you decide to be in this business is fine. But giving it away with no talent, with no foundation of hard work, without any artistry about you, it's just crazy, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Why do you think this is, Keith? Is this the emergence of social media? Because obviously when you and I started out, I've been broadcasting for nearly 30 years now. You've established that, you know, with Boyzone and everything else, 28 years and counting. So we've been around a fair chunk of time now. We've seen, before mobile phones were a thing, before cameras were so accessible, certainly before Twitter and Instagram. Do you think those are the culprits for why we have this now sort of fast, urgent desire for talent-free fame?
Absolutely, 100%. And it, my God, there's a come with it issues and its problems too, because what you're seeing on social media is not factual. It's not real. These filters that are used, these are not, you know, this catfish thing that goes on. You don't know what you're dealing with, you know. And as a result, you've got typically developing children trying to be as good as their heroes, but their heroes are not even as good as their heroes. Mm. And this then brings in the whole mental health issue, you know, and we all know, you know, how mental health has grown over the last 10, 15 years, and how very much alive and well mental health is at the moment within our society, especially after coming through a pandemic. It's putting so much pressure on the youth of today, the generation of today. The pressure is enormous on them, and the online bullying that goes on because of social media. I mean, honestly, it's terrible. And we talk about these reality stars. They've got millions of followers. And look, listen, I'm not judging them. I'm just saying that I just believe, you know, number one, you should be given a lesson that when you're making that decision to give away your private life, your anonymity, you should be told, you know, the ups and downs, the pros and cons of what your decision is going to do to you. And then you should decide really whether you want to give your life away. Look, I know a lot of people from that area, you know, from the whole reality TV that have made an absolute fortune and have provided themselves and their family a great quality of life through it. And they're being able to buy back some of their privacy by buying big houses behind electric gates. Yeah, so, I mean, there are the success stories, but it's not always that case, you know. And I think 90% of the time, it's not that case. It's you know, they enjoy their 15 minutes of fame when they're really in good shape, when they've done their few press-ups, as you say, when they've got their false tan done, and they've been on TV a couple of times, and everybody in the area where they grew up think they're fantastic and they're amazing. But then the 15 minutes is over. You're not doing as many press-ups anymore. The false tan has run out, and you need to go and get sugar or milk in the shops. And you go to the shops and you're photographed. And then you know, you were only too delighted to be photographed and pressed everywhere when you were looking fantastic. And now you're being photographed a little bit overweight, probably not as tanned, not as confident as you might have been before. And you're still photographed, and your picture's being put up. And then this causes you to have kind of mental health issues and depression and anxiety. You know, I mean, these are the things that we're trying to protect our children from. So, I mean, talking about on radio is great, you know, but it's true. And for me, it's so transparent. You know, you're setting yourself up for a fall. You know, if you really want to be famous, you know, go and go to college, go to arts college, learn, you know, busk on the side of the road. I mean, get involved in something that you're passionate about, you know. Pull out, everybody is talented. You just got to find it. You got to look for it. You got to find it, and you got to work for it. You got to caress it. You got to build it, you know, and that will build your confidence. It will make you better at it than you were before. It's a growing process. You can't get there just by one leap.
That's so insightful, Keith. And you're right, actually, it's about as well building resilience. You know, if you're famous for a talent, then like you say, you have to nurture that talent. You have to play on the side of the road. You have to go home with a cap with a few coins tossed in it and nothing more, and so on, because it builds you up. It gives you that kind of rhino hide of invincibility, so that by the time fame comes, you're untouchable. You're not bothered by trolls on social media and so on, because you've had to graft to get there. Whereas if it's an instant boom, I'm famous, yay, look at me, aren't I brilliant, the minute those nasty people turn around and go, actually, no, you're not, you've got no defense against it.
You've got no defense, and you've got no depth of character. You know, the depth of character is brought on not only by success but by failure too, you know. And those difficult times when you can't succeed, and difficult times, look at, you know, I mean, the boys from Boyzone and, you know, and a lot of the bands that I knew, we, you know, we the five of us were all born in the north side of Dublin. You know, I remember asking my mum when I was very young, were we rich? And she told me that we were rich in love. And I thought that was a cop-out. And now I kind of understood what she meant. You know, financially, we certainly were nowhere near rich. You know, we there was bills to be paid at the end of the week. My mum and my dad worked. They provided very well. We ate very well. We were dressed very well. But we didn't have an awful lot left after that. You know, there wasn't an awful lot left after that. We didn't have foreign holidays, you know. If we were lucky, you know, you go to a mobile home park in the coast, the east coast or the west coast of Ireland, you know. And to be honest, they were the best holidays we ever had in our lives. I mean, some of the best memories I have as a child is in one of those mobile home parks, you know, down in Wexford or in Kerry or in one of the coastal kind of counties of Ireland. And they're the most amazing, happy memories that I have now, you know. And that didn't cost an awful lot. You know what I mean? So it's just... Yeah. It's about just keeping your feet planted on the ground and making sure you surround yourself with like-minded people that keep you grounded.
Keith, you're quite a guru. I mean, listening to you, it's quite inspiring. You've really got your finger on the pulse.
Well, like I said, yeah, it's not by choice. It's that I have three women in my life that just make sure that I don't go anywhere above my station.
Keith, we've all got one of these because, like you, I have a mum that keeps me in line and a wife that does the same. I have three boys rather than a daughter. But nonetheless, what's your, because we've all got one, you must have one. What's your I'm being told off name by your mum? Like for me, it's Andrew. I know I'm in trouble if she starts with Andrew rather than Andy. Now you, I'm trying to count them. You've got about a million middle names. Keith, Peter, well, Thomas, yeah, Francis, listen, Julian, John Duffy. That's a long name.
It's when somebody addresses you by your Christian name, which is your first name, and your surname, which is your final name. So when anybody in my family calls me Keith Duffy, then I just know instantaneously that I'm in trouble, okay? If it's Keith, I'm fine, you know? Or Duster, which is my nickname, which most people call me, that's fine. But when somebody calls me Keith Duffy, I know, oh, shit, I'm in trouble.
Yes. It's useful to have the code, though, isn't it? Because you know how to respond.
Yeah, no, it's bizarre because the only people that call me by my full name, Keith Duffy, would be, like I say, at home, my family, my mother, when I'm in trouble, or else. It's the opposite side of the coin. It's when I go to my friends' houses and I'm getting maybe to meet their kids and they've got younger kids, you know, they've got younger kids under the age of 10 or 20 even that never really heard of Boyzone and don't know who Keith Duffy is, you know. And then they meet me for the first time and then they might Google me. And then when they meet me for the second time, they talk to me with my full name. They go, hi, Keith Duffy. How are you, Keith Duffy? You know, and it's really funny. It's only kids that young kids that do it, and you know instantly that you've been Googled before you've arrived because they call you by your full name. You know, it's very funny.
Hello, it's John Markar here from our sister podcast, the Driven Chat Podcast. Right now, you're listening to the Andy J Podcast, and it's quite good, isn't it? In fact, do me a favour, give it a little review, 5 stars, and wherever you're listening, hit that little subscribe or follow button because it does help. See you around.
The Andy J Podcast.
That's quite cute, actually. It must be quite weird because... Obviously, we live in the present, Keith. You know, we have our life, which is our life right this minute. And all the stuff that's gone before that builds you to the person you are right now. But it's the past. You know, Boyzone, yes, you've reformed and you've released other albums and you've had 25th anniversary celebrations and so on. And it is a huge part of your career. You know, it was a massive part of what built you. But it is also your past. You know, it's not who you are now. Do you know what I mean?
No, absolutely. It doesn't define who I am now. I mean, I went on to do all sorts of other things. I mean, on and off, I was in Coronation Street for 10 years. You know, I joined Corey for a couple of episodes, 2 or 3 episodes in 2002. And then I came out of the show for maybe, I think it was probably 2 months, 3 months. And there was a good reaction to the character. So they got in contact and said, would I go back in and do a proper 3-month stint? And I said I would. And I was like, one episode into the 3-month stint and they signed me for another 3 months with a 3-month option. So through the jigs and the reels, I mean, I ended up staying on and off in Corrie, going in and out for 10 years. My final episode of Coronation Street was in 2012, which was 10 years after I started. So, you know, that was a completely different scenario than Boyzone. And then from that then, people started taking me serious as an actor. So I got some really great theatre work back home in Ireland, a great writer by the name of John B. Keane had written a play years ago called Big Maggie. It was set in the early 70s. I think it was in the late 60s. And a great production company in Ireland called Druid, who have won awards all over the world, from Broadway to the West End to Dublin to Ireland. And one of their directors, who's won Tony Awards and all sorts, Gary Hines, got in contact with me and auditioned me to play a part in John B. Keane's playing Big Maggie, which we did. And we sold out all over the country. We sold out. We'd done a run in the Gaiety Theatre in Dublin. And I think we've done a run for 6 or 8 weeks, completely sold out. And that was an amazing experience. You know, that was a frightful and amazing experience, because you're going out on stage, you know, hoping that people can see through your boy's own character of Keith Duffy.
Yeah.
Seeing the character of Teddy Healing, which is the name of the character I was playing. And then for you to hold them in that gaze and keep them believing that you are that character, and then do justice to a great writer's work and to make people believe what you're doing. And then, on top of all that, to remember like a 4 or 5 page monologue on each scene that you're doing. It was frightening, but I really enjoyed the scare factor, the fear factor of standing up there with the whites of people's eyes looking at you as you owned the stage and delivered your lines, you know. And I went on then to do work in the West End, and I did a great, there was a great writer by the name of Billy Roach from Wexford, and he wrote a play called A Handful of Stars, which is part of a trilogy written for the Tricycle in London back in the late 70s, early 80s. And we only did that in a fringe theatre in London, but there's only 1% of fringe theatre shows that are invited into the West End, and we got that invitation. So we went into Trafalgar Studios. It's a small space in the semi round. I think it has about 140 seats. That's all. And we were doing 8 shows a week, and it was just amazing. It was just an amazing experience to be in the half round. And literally, you walk out on stage, you can hear a pin drop, you can see the whites of people's eyes. It's terrifying. I mean, I could stand on stage in Hyde Park in front of 125,000 people and have no issues and no problems whatsoever with Boyzone, and then go to the Trafalgar Studios, 140 people in the half round, and absolutely shit myself.
Well, it's twice as impressive, though, isn't it, Keith? Because the thing is, you know, you go to a casting agent right now, and this is testament to your talent as an actor, actually. And the casting agent, let's say they're seeing 5 people for a role. Now, 4 of those people aren't Keith Duffy. One of them is. And you have to show him that you're able to not be Keith Duffy, which is that instant thing that people will see. Like you say, when you stand on a stage, people look at you and say, I think Boyzone. Or Coronation Street, or Boy's Life. You know, that's what they think. They don't kind of think, ooh, who's he going to be? And then when you start acting and you take them away from the persona that they know you as, that is a huge deal, man. That is like, that's like, you've got to work twice as hard as the other actors to get these parts, presumably.
Absolutely. And sometimes instantly as you walk into the room, it's no.
Oh.
You know, sometimes it's just an absolute no. Sometimes the casting director can't see past Keith Duffy from Boyzone, and you know what, they've a job to do, they've got people to answer to, and they're not prepared to take the chance on you, so they will just go no. You know, sometimes the audience will love the show and the audience will decide no, and it's never the majority, it's only a minority. You know, so it takes people with balls to be able to take the chance on you sometimes, and that's exactly what a guy called Kieran Roberts did when I started in Coronation Street. Kieran Roberts, you know, he had balls. He was the executive producer of Coronation Street. They wanted an Irish guy in Curry. He brought me in. We spoke for an hour and a half in his office. He screen tested me twice. They auditioned me twice or 3 times. And I think, you know, the casting directors, the group of people, I think the general kind of feeling was probably it's not a great idea. But Kieran Roberts stuck to his guns. You know, he gets the last say. And he gave me a chance. And ultimately, the bizarre thing about it was, and I remember when it really was working, was because I haven't done 6 or 8 months in Coronation Street, and I was flying back from Malaga Airport after having a holiday with the family. I was flying back on my own early because I had to get back to work, and they were staying on for a week. And these 2 little kids, about 11 or 12 years of age, two little boys, came running up to me. I was in the EasyJet queue to get my flight back to Manchester to go back
living that showbiz life, Keith. That showbiz life. What a show off.
My private jet that's painted orange and it has Easy written on the side.
And lots of other random friends. Yeah,
and lots of random friends. Yeah, I'm very popular. And these two kids run up to me and asked me, was I Kieran? Are you Kieran? Are you Kieran McCarthy from Coronation Street? And
brilliant.
That was the first time in my life that somebody had kind of not known who Keith Duffy from Boyzone was, but now I'm somebody else. Now I'm Kieran from Coronation Street, which was a bizarre moment.
How did that make you feel?
It made me feel great. It made me feel great because it made me feel that I'd achieved the job at hand, which was making people see me as somebody else. Okay, granted, they didn't have to see past Keith Duffy from Corrie or from Boyzone because they didn't know who Boyzone were, but they did see me as Kieran from Corrie. Ultimately, people that did know me as Keith from Boyzone, they're calling me Kieran and then apologising for the fact, which I thought was quite funny. But one way or another, you know, I was doing a good enough job to stay there on and off for 10 years, which in fact, my dad, God rest him, he, unfortunately, I lost him a few weeks ago. My dad was always very, very honest with me. My dad would have been my biggest critic, you know, and my dad would have been the man I'd go to for advice. So when your worst critic is the man you go to for advice and he's happy with what he sees, it's a pretty good place, you know, it's a pretty good place to be. But he would say to me, you know, you got a contract to go into Corrie for 3 episodes and you stayed for 10 years. You think it was because you were good. It was only because they were waiting for you to get good.
<You know? laughs> They gave you lots of learning time.
yeah, they gave you lots of learning time, exactly.
Oh,
exactly,
bless him. You know? Oh, amazing. I mean, look, Keith, this is the first time that you and I have made friends. So, you know, I don't know how much I can sort of open these doors because you've already asserted you are a private person. But you mentioned your father, Sean, I believe his name was. He died on the 8th of January this year. Can I ask how you're doing, man? Because that, for any son, for any person, obviously, losing their father, but for any son, especially, I believe you two were really close, it's absolutely crippling, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's not something that any of us, I believe, can prepare for. I mean, my dad had been sick before, and he was a real fighter. He'd never let anybody beat him, or any illness beat him. He had the big C. I remember it was about it was 2003 or 2004. So that's possibly about 16 or 17 years ago, I was getting a lift to Manchester Airport on a Friday evening, as usual, to try and get home to Dublin for the weekend to see my family. And I got a phone call telling me that, look, my dad's been given bad news that he has the big C. And, you know, when I got home, I went to see him, and he was very positive. He was in good form. Long story short, he beat it. He had to get some chemo. He had to get some radiation. And, you know, true, it was a long process, don't get me wrong, and it was a tough time, but he got through it, he beat it, but it came back again. And look, long story short, he beat it again. But it came back again, and the January 2020, which is just over 14 months ago, he was given the all clear for the third time, which we were absolutely delighted about, and he was very proud of, because, you know, with going through cancer and you know, receiving chemotherapy, you know, as a lot of people listening will know, that it can break down your immune system and it leaves you open to catch other insignificant illnesses that possibly can go on to kill you because your immune system is low, you know. So he not only had beaten cancer, he'd beaten all these other insignificant kind of illnesses too. His oncologist brought him in then and just wanted to give him a checkup, make sure he was doing okay. So he had a PET scan at the end of January, I think into February. And coming into March then, unfortunately, his oncologist told him that the cancer had come back and it had come back quite aggressively. So that was March 2020. 2021. So just a year ago.
Right.
And my dad said, well, look, what's the problem? We fought it before. We beat it. Let's fight it again. And his oncologist said, look, Sean, it's going to be very hard on the body. You know, you've done this a long time now. And you know, he said, I just have to tell you, like, it is going to be tough on the body. He said, look, I've done it before, I'll do it again. He was an amazing man, a warrior of a man, you know. And myself and my brothers are all taller than my dad. Like you, I come from, well, you have three boys. I come from a family of three boys. I have an older brother and a younger brother. And we were all taller than my dad. You know, my dad was only a small man, like, I think 5'7". 5'7½" maybe. He would have loved that extra half an inch.
Yeah, can't miss it out.
You know, and he, I'd say, oh, Dad, I'm taller than you now. And my dad would always say, listen, son, you might be taller than me, but you'll never be bigger than me. You know, and and it's only in recent times I realized what he meant by that. But so look, it came back and he fought it again. And this is the breaking, you know, the heartbreaking part of the story. The Wednesday before Christmas passed. He was brought in after a PET scan, and his oncologist said to him, Sean, I can't believe I'm saying this to you, but you're cancer free. You've beaten it yet again. You've got it. The chemo's worked. The tumor's gone. You're cancer free. You're in remission. Go and celebrate Christmas with your family. And I was having all my family to my house for Christmas this year. Everybody, my wife's folks were coming, and my folks were coming, and we were going to have a big celebratory Christmas in my house this Christmas. And my wife, unfortunately, got COVID 2 days before Christmas.
Oh, no.
And with my dad's immune system being so low and stuff, we just said, look, guys, we're going to have to postpone Christmas this year because we can't take any risks.
Yeah.
Like, my wife's folks are elderly as well, and we just didn't want to take any risks. When I say elderly, they're only in their 70s, as was my dad, you know, I mean, which is a young age these days.
It is.
So we made all the precautions. We made sure we'd done everything right. And I delivered out a ham and turkey to my mom and dad. I delivered out a ham and turkey to Lisa's mom and dad to make sure everybody had their Christmas dinner, along with a couple of nice bottles of wine and everything else, all the trimmings that goes with it, just to make sure that they were being safe and they were staying away from COVID. And my dad left the house, I think it was about the 29th. We're making out it was the 29th or 30th of December. Felt very ill on New Year's Eve, was taken into hospital on the 2nd of January, was diagnosed with COVID and died on the 8th of January.
Oh, man.
So it was all very, very sudden, especially after being sent home to celebrate after his long battle with cancer and having beaten it for the fourth time. So, you're asking me how am I doing? I'm doing what I think my father would expect me to do, which is stand tall, look after the family, look, take care of my mother, and you know, when I have a moment of silence, I crawl under a rock and I have a little cry. But yeah, I mean, it's tough losing a parent. And my dad was my hero. He was the reason I'm in the music business. He was a singer. He played accordion from the age of 8. He was a piano player. He played guitar. You know, he was an all rounder. You know, on the amateur circuit, yeah, maybe, because he was a tailor as well. But yeah, you know, it's one of those things that I suppose you learn day by day, and they say time is a great healer, and I think what they mean by that is, you know, a greater amount of time comes between the moments when you get struck by the thunderbolt of lightning of reality that he's gone, and you have your moment of weakness and sadness and emotion, and you pick yourself up because of the great memories that you have, and you move forward. But like, the reality is losing a parent is possibly one of the worst things in the world that can happen to you. You know, and I'm feeling that now. I'm sad for my dad because, you know, he had fought so hard not to let this beat him. And then just to kind of get uppercut by COVID when he wasn't watching. You know, he wasn't ready to go, and he hadn't prepared himself for you know, making that transition to the next life, and that was the sad part about it. You know, in the hospital, sitting with him in his final hours, and I think, you know, the palliative care team had made him very comfortable. But having said that, like, he hadn't the strength to talk to us then. But you could see his emotion in his face and the reality in his face. That moment when he realized that he wasn't going to get better, when he realized we were all there for a reason, that he was making his journey, and that was possibly the saddest thing that I've ever seen, you know, especially, and frustrating too, because when you see someone you love in that vulnerable situation, you want to try and help. And when you're helpless, when there's nothing you can do, it becomes apparent, you know, that's what makes it very, very sad and upsetting. But, you know, he leaves a great legacy behind him in his kids and his grandchildren in what he achieved himself in life and from the memories that he gave us. So, yeah, it's sad and it's unfortunate, but you have to try and find the positives. And my dad was a very strong, sturdy man. Like I said to you earlier on, we might have been taller than him, but we'll never be bigger than him. And I try to have his strength in everything I do now. But yes, thank you for asking. I appreciate it.
Well, bless you, mate. You know, I'm really sorry. I didn't know the ins and outs, and you know, it's not my business to ask. But I was sort of checking if you were okay, because it's one of those things that I think everybody dreads. It's that I think the two things that adults fear are losing children and losing parents, and one of them we know
it's a different story. A parent should never have to bury a child. I mean that's a different scenario altogether. People get old, they get sick, we expect them to pass on, but when somebody loses their life way too early, you know, and a parent has to bury a child, that's a different scenario altogether. I mean that's something that I never want to experience, and I pray to God that I never do. You know, we love our children dearly, and you know, like I say, it's not easy losing any member of a family or a friend. You know, losing anybody is difficult, but you know, losing a parent is particularly bad. But certainly nowhere near what it would be like to lose a child.
No, of course not. I wasn't sort of making that comparison. I was just saying it's one of those things that you always have it in the back of your mind. You know, the nightmare scenario, and you were aware.
And you asked me the question, and I was you know, you're saying it was none of your business. I could have said that, but I was happy to answer you because I'm enjoying our conversation, and I'll always be honest with someone who's done their homework and knows what they're talking about. Because that's great. You appreciate it in this business.
Oh, bless you, mate. Well, you know, thank you for that. That's really kind of you. I mean, I know you've probably done many thousands of interviews in your life. So I'm sort of aware coming into this that, you know, there might be a degree of you just going through the motions, because all the people ask the same old questions and the same stuff comes up. So when you have the opportunity to be real like you have been, I really do appreciate it, Keith, because it's...
Well, no, listen, it's my pleasure, because... Honest to God, you do, like you say, I've done millions of interviews in the past, and it's only when you get onto a journalist or a journalistic presenter or something, you know, after the first or second question that they've done absolutely no homework at all. They haven't, you know, prepared for the interview. They don't really give a shit who you are. They're not trying to promote whatever it is you're selling. They're just doing their job or what they're told to do. So when you get somebody like you that knows their history, that has done their homework, that knows the person, it's so exhilarating that, you know, you can ask me anything now and I'll probably tell you.
What's your PIN number, Keith?
Yeah. Yeah, there you go. I'd have to ask my wife. Hang on.
Oh, good times, mate. Good times. Well, bless you. That's really kind. Let's talk about fatherhood in that case, Keith, because it's something that's very important to both of us. I think it's fair to say, in the brief time that you and I have got to make friends here, you know, it's very clear to me that like me, fatherhood is something that you are intensely proud of, and it hopefully defines who you are as a man.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, yeah. I mean, the relationship I have with my children, I love dearly. I have to say, I mean, I'd be lost without both of them. It's amazing. And that's the one thing that the pandemic really did for me. It gave me an opportunity to spend, you know, quality, undivided time at home. And in this business, it's something that we never usually get. You know, I've always been based in Dublin and Ireland, even though through the whole boys' own days and obviously the Corey stages and more recently the boys' life stages, a lot of our work is based in the UK. A lot of our work is based out of London. We tried to base it from Manchester because both Brian McFadden, obviously, who's in Boys Life with me, both of us have a base in Manchester. So basing ourselves there is a lot easier than London. But London is a place that we have to visit quite a lot as well. So you get to spend a lot of time away from home. You know, you spend a lot of time on tour. Just like I said earlier on in the interview, you have to sacrifice. When you have a family in this business, you have to sacrifice a great deal. When you're single in this business, you have the time of your life, I would imagine, allegedly, because I've never been single.
I was going to say, you've never known that.
I know, but I've had loads of friends in this business that I've watched have a great time.
Yeah, and I bet you've been thrilled for them.
I was absolutely over the moon for them. I know, but you know, it was never an option for me to move the family to the UK because my daughter, Mia, who's 22, who's 22
this
yesterday,
month, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. she was diagnosed with autism at 18 months, and she was nonverbal until she was just over seven years of age.
Gosh,
and
right.
To any parent listening, you can imagine how scary that is when you like I had a typically developing son, firstborn Jay, who's going to be 26 next month. And then 4 years later, we have Mia, who was a completely different child altogether, that was non-responsive. We had no idea what was going on. We really didn't know what we were talking about. Ultimately, she was diagnosed with autism at 18 months. And we were lucky to have that diagnosis that young, because
yes, that is
there was
rare.
A waiting list in Ireland for diagnosis of up to 3 years. So
wow.
I had to pull strings. I had to pay privately. I had to do all sorts of stuff to get a diagnosis. And you need a diagnosis before you can avail of any services or even find out what services are available.
Yes.
And I say it like that because when we were diagnosed and we could avail of the services, we realized there weren't any. And we had to provide them ourselves, which took me down a whole different route in my life that I didn't expect. And I started up a charity and I started up an awareness campaign, a fundraising campaign to try and implement and put in place the appropriate intervention for children with autism and children and their families affected by autism. And that took up a great deal of my life. I sacrificed my career for a few years until I got a better handle on my daughter and where she needed to go and what she needed to happen for her. I'm delighted to kind of make a long story short to tell you that she's now finishing her fourth year in university enterprise computing. She's just interviewed for many of the bigger companies in the world, like Microsoft, Dell, Amazon, Google. And I'm delighted to say that she has had a formal offer from a large company for to start her post-grad. So to come from where we've come from with a non-verbal daughter with autism to receiving a post-grad offer from a major worldwide company is just phenomenal for us. And it's nothing to do with me or who I am or what I do. She has done it all for herself. But the point I was making was, because of this disability, I always had to keep my base in Ireland, because the education that we had provided for her was second to none, and she possibly wouldn't have received it as well in the UK. And obviously the sacrifices we made now have paid off now with the fact that Mia's future looks very bright. But like, as a father, I spent a great deal amount of time away from home trying to provide for their future and make sure they'd have a good quality of life. But through the pandemic, all work was cancelled. We were all sent home, and I got to spend nearly 2 years stuck in the house for the first time in my life with my wife and my two kids. And lovely. The four of us, the first 2 or 3 weeks was difficult because we had to get used to each other. We had to find out, you know, they had a routine that I wasn't part of, and they had to open up and let me in. And you know what? I never appreciated my home, my garden. I never really kind of took any great value for it because I was never here that much. But through the whole pandemic, I got to appreciate and really understand my family. And we got so, I thought we couldn't get closer. I thought we were a close-knit family already. But the friendships that we have now, we don't only love each other, we like each other too. And you know, I that is a blessing, that this, the silver lining that this COVID, this pandemic has given us. This, you know, it took my father away, but it also, it gave me a much better quality of life with my family. So, you know, you've got to be grateful for the positive things as well.
Absolutely. No, you always have to count your blessings. And one thing that I think is worth pointing out as well, Keith, just in case the listeners haven't kind of made the connection, is hearing Mia's success and how brilliant that she's gone on to shine. I'm absolutely thrilled to hear that. Is that we need to be kind of aware of that word autism and not afraid of it, actually.
Well, that's it. What I say is, I mean, you hear people saying, oh, that guy is autistic or that girl is autistic. And I go, no, they're not. Because that's not who they are. That's, you know, and that's not what they are, you know. That guy over there has autism. Or that young girl over there is a girl with autism. They're not autistic. They're, you know, it, that's just something personal to me. I just think, you know, by kind of branding someone autistic, it is wrong. Saying that person has autism. Do you understand what I'm trying to say?
Yes, I do.
It doesn't define who they are. You know, it's not what they are. Autism is not what they are. You know, having autism is who they are. You know what I mean? It's a difference. And look, you know, with the right intervention and early intervention and hard work, you know, great things are achieved, you know, and there is light at the end of the tunnel for those families out there that are listening.
Yes, and this is something that you've been a terrific advocate for a long time, actually, Keith. And I, you know, more power to you. I'm so pleased that famous voices like yours have been lending yourselves to such important causes, because it's really, you know, it's really necessary for people to have a better understanding and not to be afraid of these things. And actually, this leads us on to something that I promised you we'd talk about, Keith, and I'm afraid we're losing it towards the end, but we'll make the most of the time we've got left, because you are so sort of immersed in understanding progression through children and seeing kids blossom through different ways, that there's been this new Imagination Index report about called Teaching Through Toys. And you've been swatting up about it, about what's happened basically during the pandemic to our children.
Well, yeah, look, it's not even that I was swatting up about it. It's something I know only too well. You know, through looking at the various educational systems that are put in place for children on the spectrum, or even children with ADHD or whatever type of disability, you know, learning through playtime is very, very important, you know. And through the pandemic, Zuru Toys, who are a very, very successful toy company, have spent a fortune, you know, having a report done to find out the percentages and the statistics of how playtime is so important for children, you know, neurotypical children and neurodiverse children, you know. And it's just trying to preach and to get out there the importance of playtime with children, the importance of the various different objects, you know, because playtime is educational, you know. The likes of a tablet, you know, the likes of a tablet now, you know, whatever make it might be, Samsung, Apple, whatever it might be, there's apps on these tablets now that are so educational for kids, and they love to use them, you know. And it's better than sitting in front of a computer game for 12 hours. You can sit in front of a tablet, there's apps on there that help with speech, that help with learning, that help with colors, that help with animals. I mean, we didn't have a tablet back in the day of when my daughter probably, you know, could have really, really done with one. You know, we didn't have the apps. We had to have physical toys to play with, educational toys to play with. And that's why I'm delighted this company, Zuru, because they are a multi-billion pound company. But they've invested huge money into the statistics of how important playtime can be on a learning side, not just on a play side. Like these new fidget toys that kids are playing with, you know, they're amazingly important for children on the spectrum that find ordinary kind of scenarios or ordinary places, you know, scary places, you know, supermarkets, restaurants, anywhere you have to go, like a waiting room in a doctor's surgery, anywhere, all these places where there's other human beings there. The environment can be a very scary place for children on the spectrum. So to give them some sort of a toy to calm them down in that scenario, to keep them, you know, happy within their environment is very important. So these new fidget toys are gas. I mean, I've seen loads of kids playing with them, but I didn't really kind of know what they were. And it's only since reading up now I've realized that they are educational, because they help you count, they help you calm, they help you, you know, just you know, kind of isolate yourself from the distractions that are around you, that upset you, that could cause you to have, you know, upsetting moments.
Yes.
I mean, there's things that set kids off in our ordinary environment. Like if you go into a supermarket, for example, and you have a fluorescent tube that might need replacing, so it's kind of flickering and flashing, that can make a child with autism go into a panic, go into a tantrum, and it's out of fear. It's not out of them being naughty children or bold kids. They're actually terrified, you know. And to the untrained eye, to the ignorant eye, you know, other people look upon and go, oh, that child just needs a good slap in the bum. They're very naughty children. But ultimately, you know, the parents are there trying to kind of keep their child happy, you know. So kind of helping the child and educating the child how to calm themselves down in an environment that's scary is very important. And toys and playtime are a very educational time for these children. And it's trying to get that message out there that it is important.
Yes, absolutely.
Especially through the pandemic, that's when parents really realized, because they were trying to educate their kids through playtime what COVID was, what a pandemic was, you know, what transdiversity is, you know, and trying to educate kids on the ways of the world today through playtime.
Yeah, and actually the study has been really, really impactful. you know, that Zuru, as you say, have done it. And one of the things that struck out for me, because of course all our kids, they weren't able to go to school, they weren't able to socialise and so on. 29% of British kids have said that during the pandemic they felt more irritable. 26% felt more sad throughout the course of the pandemic. And that, you know, these are big numbers of kids here. And actually, to kind of read through the importance of these toys and gadgets that help with stress and anxiety. You know, you've mentioned the tablets, books are a big one, fidget toys, as you say, plush toys, arts and crafts, you know, these things. And then there's the toys that help you with facilitating learning, and books, understandably, right at the top of that, Keith. But let's not rule out the others in there. Puzzles, arts and crafts, the tablet again, and playing board games. You know, getting involved with your children, doing things with them, using board games, using arts and crafts, tablets and so on. Get stuck in. Help them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, most kids today know how to use a smartphone. From the age of 8 months old, they know how to use a smartphone.
That's true. Yeah.
But, you know, that's fine. That's okay. You know, but get the apps on the phone that are educational, that are going to help them survive in our society, that are going to help their minds build and grow. I mean, look, my daughter's 22 now, and like I said, she's doing great. We're very proud of her. But when we go out sometimes to a restaurant or to anywhere we have to go, she can find the distractions around her terrifying. So she does Sudoku, and she loves her Sudoku.
Okay.
So she'll always pack her Sudoku in her bag with her in case she finds herself in an environment where she's not comfortable or she's not happy. And she'll take out her Sudoku, and she'll block out everything around her, and she'll do her Sudoku. She gets fed up doing Sudoku. She'll take out puzzles. She'll take out like crosswords. She'll take it. So she's, you know, and this is something that we implemented years ago. So now she knows her figures. She knows her words. She knows her word search. And that's very educational, and it's helped her no end in college and studies, you know. And like I say, she's in her fourth year in university now. And yeah, I have to kind of remind people, Mia didn't go to ordinary school. Mia was, like, you know, nonverbal till she was 7 years of age, you know, but with the right playtime and educational playtime, which makes it enjoyable for the kids so they're not dreading doing it, helps them learn on a basis that they're continuing to learn the whole time. And the difference, the long-term difference, is massive, but you've got to start somewhere.
Yes, absolutely. And it sounds to me, Keith, if you don't mind me saying, that Mia's luckiest break was having you and your wife as her parents.
Well, it's very kind of you to say, and I think, well, I owe Mia a great deal, because, you know, I was working early, from an early age. I was selling potatoes and vegetables from the side of the road when I was 13 or 14 years of age, you know, just trying to kind of help situations at home. Not that they were that bad, but I was always a grafter, and I always liked having a few pounds in my pocket or a few pence in my pocket. So I had to go out and make it for myself, you know. So, academically, I never would have given myself much credit. In fact, I didn't enjoy school very much at all. And through Mia's situation, I've had to go back and learn and read an awful lot more than I ever read before. I had to scour the internet, Google everything, educate myself and learn. And I never really believed I had the ability to be able to learn and to do what I did, or to succeed in the way I succeeded, unless Mia kind of challenged me. And so I owe her a great deal, because I have a lot more respect for myself now than I ever did before. And that's down to the challenges that were put in front of me because of my daughter.
What a lovely thing to hear. Keith, it's been a really, really interesting, fascinating and very educational hour chatting to you, actually. I really appreciate your company. Thank you very much.
Listen, it's likewise, as they said in the movie Ghost, ditto.
I'll go and get my pottery wheel, Keith.
Yeah, but just make sure I don't come up behind you. That wouldn't be nice.
Oh, look, we've got to mention, of course, the band. We've only touched on Boys Life, of course, which you're going on tour again. I'm sorry, I should have said that earlier on. Of course, anybody that isn't aware of this, they should be. You've had this band with Brian. In fact, we spoke to Brian a couple of years ago on this show about it. You know, you and Brian McFadden have been pulling up trees with Boys Life. I mean, you've been touring everywhere. You've got tunes out left, right and centre. And that's going to continue, isn't it?
Absolutely. Only yesterday, Friday, we brought out our third single from our first debut album. When I say debut album, we brought out an album of our favourite Boyzone and Westlife songs with the Royal Philharmonic, an 84-piece orchestra. And we brought that out during the pandemic, during the lockdown. But we've recently brought out a very first self-penned original album called Old School. and it's on all the ordinary on your usual platforms. Our third single, A Little Saving, came out yesterday, and it's and you can find it. It's there. And our first single was called The One. The second was called Born For You. But our third single called A Little Saving came out yesterday. And it's a song that we wrote being very aware of mental health in our environment, in our industry, and in our life today. So give it a listen and see what you think.
I'm all over it. Keith, you're a top man. I've really enjoyed this chat. Thank you very much for your company.
Thank you very much, Andy, and thanks to your listeners for listening in.
Amazing. Have a great day, Keith, and I wish you all the success. I can't wait to see what happens next.
The Andy J Podcast.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.